Hello, this is Tom McSweeney, and you're very welcome to my maritime podcast and programme, the only regular broadcast source reporting on Ireland's maritime sector, its development, culture, history and traditions. Some good maritime news to start the April edition. The 4th of this year, Irish sailing is in a healthy state. Our sailors, young sailors particularly, are doing well internationally. 5 World Championship wins, 2 European Championships and 2 bronze medals, and Ireland has qualified for the Paris Olympics. After a year of change at the National Sailing Organisation, which the Chief Executive Tim Burke described as evolution rather than revolution, when many of the previous administration departed, there is, he said, opportunity to restructure Irish sailing. John Toomey is president of the national organisation. A Paralympian several times and keelboat sailor at Kinsale Yacht Club in County Cork, he started his second year at the annual general meeting, where he told me there is huge potential for more people to join the sport.
Sailing is in a very healthy state, Tom. We're growing the membership and the participation on the water is growing as well, you know. We reckon there's between 60 and 90,000 people actively involved in sailing and water sport at the moment. They're not all documented or grown to about 27,000, which is an increase again over 2022, 2021. So we're growing the membership. But, you know, we don't always capture all those members in clubs or organisations. There are people doing their own thing on the water. And I suppose the main thing is that the water facilities in Ireland, both the lakes and the sea, is being used regularly and enjoyed by the people of the country.
There is an increase in participation. Also, you make the point, an increase in female participation, which sailing has been trying to get.
That's very important, Tom. You know, the Women in the Water programme is something that we're actively promoting and actively, you know, organising around the country. But there's also the fact that Sport Ireland put a quota on the amount of female members we have on the board now, and that's healthy, because sometimes clubs in the past were tend to be male dominated on the board and in the management committees. You know, that's something now that's being addressed both by ourselves as a national governing body, because we've always had a good healthy participation at board and club management level. But it's now coming in right across the board. And, you know, we're well ahead of the field. If you see the published statistics that are out there, we're over the 40%. We're heading up towards 50%. And we're one of the leading governing bodies of sport in Ireland in that field.
One of the points you make particularly in your report is the importance of developing the National Water Sports Centre.
Well, the National Water Sport Campus is a project that's being fostered by Dunleary Rathdown County Council. Now, they have inherited from the Department of the Marine the actual ownership of Dunleary Harbour, and they're promoting a water sport campus there for, you know, the governing bodies of the different water sports, but also to open up the magnificent facility that's there to the public in general, so they can participate in water sport. And we're one of the governing bodies who are sponsoring this, because to go for government funding, Dunleary Rathdown require a national governing body as a sponsor of this as well for them. And we permitted funding from Irish Sailing and clubs in the Dunleary area to fund towards feasibility study for the water sport campus. We have a big sports campus in Abbottstown, but unfortunately Abbottstown is inland and can't cater other than for the swimming pool and the swimming water facilities in the indoors things. They can't cater out there, so it will be an equivalent for water sports to Abbottstown.
Finally, John, we would as a country appear to be well prepared amongst younger sailors coming up internationally and for the Olympics.
Yes, our pathway programme is starting to bear fruition. For a country of less than 5 million people to be second in the medals table internationally is a wonderful achievement, you know. And we're looking for increased funding from Sport Ireland. We're looking for funding from sponsors, from commercial activities to boost our, you know, participation at underage level in sailing, and to get those members who have a desire to go on the high performance pathway to have a proper pathway for them to develop up into potential Olympic sailors.
John Toomey, president of Irish Sailing, a Paralympian, wheelchair bound, who exudes confidence about the future of the sport, which provides great opportunity to get out and enjoy the water. Sailing has changed its profile from being regarded as exclusive to being a sport for all. Why? Even I managed to go sailing. Change is widespread in all facets of life. The upcoming European elections mean the Commissioner for the Environment, Oceans and Fisheries, Virginijus Sinkevičius, will complete his term in office, marking that he has announced that a full evaluation of the Common Fisheries Policy, CFP, will be undertaken. That policy, it's fair to say, is not liked in the Irish fishing industry, because it's given non-Irish EU member states the biggest amount of fishing catches in Irish waters, and kept the Irish share so low that our industry has suffered. Our national fleet is not allowed to catch enough fish. For years, the Irish industry has been seeking a complete review of that policy, backed by a report from a government-appointed committee, which was rejected by the EU Commissioner. So, why has he now announced a full evaluation? And note those words. Long years in journalism have taught me to note the use of words, particularly in political statements. Evaluation, as stated by the Commissioner, and review, as sought by the Irish industry, are words with very different meanings. So, while there has been a welcome for the Commissioner's announcement, there is also caution, and the national media here has reported in error that the Commissioner announced a review. He didn't, hence the caution. Read my detailed analysis in the April edition of the Marine Times newspaper to get the full story. In 1870, the city of Ragusa crossed the Atlantic Ocean. It wasn't the city itself. It was the first small boat to sail the Atlantic, and that was the name it had been given. It was crewed by two men, and Anton O'Callaghan, our historian, now tells the story.
...1870 was a significant year in the annals of Cork history. During the summer months, a major strike by the city's tailors took place, leading at one point to serious rioting on the streets. The tailors' strike was the main news story of the day, commanding pages of newspaper coverage. Perhaps not many people would have had any knowledge of the departure of a small 20-foot yawl called the City of Ragusa from Queenstown Cove today, en route to New York on Thursday the 16th of June of that year, the smallest vessel to undertake the challenge of crossing the fearsome Atlantic. At just 2 tons, the City of Ragusa was owned by Croatian-born Nikola Primorac. The vessel was originally a clinker-built ship's lifeboat, but prior to 1870, she was decked and yawl-rigged, capable of carrying 70 square yards of canvas. A windmill powered a propeller, which could also be hand-operated should the wind fail. She had a pumping mechanism, and also a cockpit and cabin that was 4.5 feet high from floor to ceiling. Fully kitted out, she carried 100 gallons of fresh water, as well as 3 months' victuals. Had a means of distilling water from seawater, and cooking was by spirit lamp. The decking and refurbishment of the vessel was done in Liverpool by Irishman Captain James Charles Buckley, and he and Primorac constituted the entire crew for the adventure, along with a large Newfoundland dog. Originally from Limerick, James Charles Buckley also spent some of his early years at Mill Street, where he had relatives. He joined the Irish Constabulary, but finding it not to his liking, joined the Royal Marines and served during the Crimean War. In 1858, he was awarded the Humane Society Medal for saving two colleagues from drowning. Then, in 1860, he joined the Papal Army and was awarded the honour of Knight of St. Sylvester. After that, he joined the Merchant Navy, achieving the rank of Master on large ships on the China trade routes. The adventure to sail such a small vessel across the Atlantic began at Liverpool, but the two crew and their dog spent 4 days in Queenstown to effect repairs before setting sail again on Thursday, June 16th. Reporting on the journey, the Nina Guardian painted the bleak circumstances under which the two men laboured. There were strong westerly winds almost from the beginning. The first 35 days, the weather was uniformly rough. The bark commenced leaking badly, and one man had to be constantly working the pump. For 3 weeks or more, they had to live on raw meat and hard bread. Despite meeting a severe storm on the 4th of July, they drank the health of President Grant and all his relatives. By now, Captain Buckley had changed his plans to reach New York and set course instead for Boston. But even that action did not guarantee their safe arrival. In late August, after almost 3 months at sea, they met a fierce storm off the George's Banks between Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and Nova Scotia. Numerous vessels were wrecked, but the city of Ragusa, with not a plank in her over half an inch thick, danced around the mad waves the whole night long, despite the loss of a jib, according to reports. Two vessels that they encountered, the SS Russia and the SS Abyssinia, brought news to Ireland that despite their struggles, all was well with Buckley and Primorac. And on the 8th of September, they reached Boston, having spent over 90 days at sea, and were greeted and towed to their berth. Sadly, their faithful dog did not complete the journey, one report saying it was lost to the storms that befell them a week previously, although another did say that it was left behind at Queenstown owing to fresh water supply concerns. The city of Ragusa was visited by interested onlookers and dignitaries alike, including President Grant. Having suffered inevitable damage on her journey, she was repaired at Boston and then sailed to New York, where she remained for the winter. Later, Primorac brought the vessel back to Liverpool via Queenstown once more, but Buckley was not with him. He went on to serve with Captain John Scott on the sailing ship Hypatia. Having returned to England, the city of Ragusa, with her newfound fame, was exhibited in various places, including the Crystal Palace, and finally at Liverpool Museum. That, however, became her final resting place. She was destroyed in 1941 when Liverpool was bombed.
So the city of Ragusa was destroyed in the bombing of the city of Liverpool. Antoine O'Callaghan there telling the story of the first small boat to sail the Atlantic. Now to another small boat crossing the Atlantic, fostering interest in the sea and developing cultural links amongst pupils and schools thousands of miles apart. Last June, I was the only journalist to take an interest in the small unmanned boat which sailed the Atlantic and was washed up in Barry's Cove on the West Cork coastline, found by local fisherman Billy McCarthy and his daughter Katie. They took it to the local Barry Row National School, where with the work of Rory Jackson, who runs West Cork Ocean Tours, it was refurbished, renamed after the school Railt na Móra, and sent back on the return journey with the help of the container ship Independent Horizon, a caller to Cork Port. The boat arrived back in USA waters off Nantucket, Cape Cod, Massachusetts, a historic American maritime location. And the story has developed further. I was invited to Barry Row National School 2 weeks ago when teachers from Morristown Baird School in Boston, which had originally sent the mini boat off, visited in a follow-up by the Educational Passages Project, which has sent 200 unmanned little boats from the US on various sea voyages to link nations and raise understanding of the oceans. Barry Row pupils linked with their USA counterparts by Zoom call, and it was great to hear the young people from both sides of the Atlantic discuss how the project has linked them and what they've learned from it. Teacher Sinead Walsh led the project at Barry Row, and Lisa Swanson was at Morristown.
Okay, Tom, as you know, our mini boat Crimson Current had landed here in Barry's Cove in 2022. And so obviously was brought here to the Barry Rowe School, and Sinead and her class were, you know, generous enough to work on it, to help us with getting it back in the water, and connecting with my students and writing letters and with a pen pal exchange, and also connecting with a number of Zooms over the course of the year. Obviously, we know that Sinead and her students were able to bring their mini boat down to the port of Cork at the end of the school year. In the meantime, my school was working on another mini boat at the time, Crimson Tide. And the ICL ship came around and picked up her boat in Cork and picked up our boat in Philadelphia. And then we're able to relaunch the boat, our both mini boats at the same time off the coast of North Carolina. So, I have a sabbatical this year from my school for the first semester, and so it's always been my dream to be able to go to some of the places where our mini boats have landed over the years. We've had a mini boat, of course, here in Ireland. We've had a mini boat land in on the island of Guernsey in France, and also in Portugal. So I'm hoping to be able to go and see some of those places. And, you know, the state of New Jersey where I teach borders the Atlantic Ocean. And I really want to be able to interact with people who live in sort of oceanside communities and talk to them about, you know, their connection to the ocean. You know, my students were an inland school, even though we border the ocean, we're several, you know, an hour and a half away from the ocean. And, you know, my students interact with the ocean, I think, more recreationally than they do maybe seeing it as sort of part of the economy. So I want to be able to bring those stories back, you know, meeting students that live in, you know, in areas that border the ocean, and what's their interaction and their connection, and how do they value the ocean?
Sinead, it's been a bit unique because the class has been linking up right across the states from the classroom. So what's the value of it for Barry Rowe National School?
It's fabulous. Do you know what is amazing, actually? It's an ongoing process. It hasn't been just one class that has benefited. You know, I suppose our first years or our last year's sixth class have returned to us, which I think shows, you know, the strength of their interest in the project as well. You could see here today, you know, some of the girls were linking up with the pen pals that they wrote over the last year. Now we're a whole year and a half ahead, and we've a new class that's going to enjoy this process again, linking up with students, looking at the currents, you know, looking at our oceans. And we've been very lucky. It's lovely to see Lisa here today, to see Cassie here today, but to have Billy and Katie and Rory as well is wonderful, because I think this is a project that we've all been working on, maybe individually and at times together, but now we're all here today to celebrate it. And this is something, Lisa, you've been doing with years. It's new for us. You know, it's been a year and a half, but in that year and a half, we've gotten so much out of it already, both the teachers, but the kids hugely. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful process for them.
Lisa, does it end here now, or is there a continuity to go on from here?
Well, no, I think it does go on. And I'm glad that Sinead also, you know, said that, you know, it's sort of ongoing. We were just talking about trying to, with her class this year, with her sixth class, to connect with my students back in New Jersey this year. So I think it's, you know, it's being able to keep those connections going, and finding ways in which we can kind of weave the mini boat and ocean education and ocean literacy into the curriculum and be able to connect in some of those points. My hope is that, you know, again, if, you know, willing, there's time in the curriculum for Sinead and I to kind of have at least an ongoing opportunity for our students to be at least pen pals, have that cultural connection, but also being able to take advantage of Rory's expertise, Billy's expertise as someone who really engages with the ocean on an everyday basis. How can we kind of bring those stories and, you know, those narratives into the classroom?
So, you sail forward for another year at least, Sinead?
Sail forward for another year. Who knows? Who knows what the high seas hold? But yeah, let's see where Crimson Current rail at Namara, yeah, and Crimson Tide. Let's see what journey they take us on next, I suppose. Yeah.
So let me finally ask the pupils. Did you learn a lot about the marine from this project?
Yes.
And prepare to go forward?
Yes. Yes.
Isn't it great that young people are enjoying the linkage of ocean friendship? Cassie Stymatest of the non-profit Educational Passages Organisation told me more about the purpose of the organisation, to connect people around the world to the oceans.
So Educational Passages, we're a non-profit in the US, and since it began, the idea started in 2008, and we've worked with people all over the world to build and launch over 200 of these mini boats, each having multiple voyages.
How do you manage to keep a project like that going? It seems astonishing that it can get such support, interest.
Well, as we heard today, you know, the communities come together and they want to help the students, right? The schools are invited, the community members are invited, and people like you are helping to share those stories. And so more people come and join our network, and it's amazing.
Now, Ireland is probably an obvious place to tides and winds, etc., to carry. But a lot of places other than Cork have shown an interest, haven't they?
Absolutely. Actually, we're here for this trip with Juliet here. Juliet is an intern at the University of New England, and she's double majoring in educational studies and marine biology. And she's interning with us at Educational Passages to relaunch the Mini Main, which is another mini boat that landed up in Waterville in 2019.
And Juliet, what's the value that you see in the project?
I think just the overall global connection between students is a very rare thing. And I think giving these students the opportunity to think of, you know, global citizenship as a whole and talk to students that they normally would not see every day and be immersed in a whole different culture, I think is just so valuable and such a rewarding thing in education that needs to be, you know, more normalized.
We've talked about the need to increase educational interest here in Ireland in the marine. Do you think a project like this is helping children to understand?
Yes, absolutely. Like, I have students from all over the world back in the U.S., and some of them have never even seen the ocean before. And not only integrating, you know, ocean literacy and things like that into it, it, you know, increases their understanding of how big the world is and how the ocean connects us all at the end of the day.
How true. Juliet Flutie, ending the lovely story of the mini boat fleet linking nations across the oceans. And if you'd like to know more about the project, go to their website, theeducationalpassages.org. Also, this month is the anniversary of the first crossing of the Atlantic by steamship, the voyage made by the Sirius from Cork, under the command of Richard Roberts from Passage West in Cork Harbour. Go to the programme website at Tom McSweeney, maritimepodcast.ie, for my Seascapes blog with the full story. The RNLI, the Lifeboat Institution, is marking its 200th anniversary this year, and as part of that commemoration, has compiled 200 voices from crews, people they've rescued, and supporters generally, of and about the RNLI. I was one of the people invited to give their views, and delighted to do so. So, in tribute to the RNLI, here's my contribution. This is what I believe to be the core of the lifeboat service.
I think the RNLI stands out for me because the core of its belief, the core of its service, is that it never has changed throughout its history. That is so amazing that it has stuck exactly to the belief it always expressed, its mission to save life. And to me, that's the essence of humanity. And I'm actually amazed as a journalist observing and reporting for so many years that in so many changes throughout the RNLI, so many changes in personnel, in administration, in the type of boats, the core of its belief has never changed, saving life at sea and going to do that no matter what the conditions in which volunteers are called to go out and save life. I can't think of a higher mission than saving life. The biggest change in the RNLI, which I've seen obviously, is the greater concern of looking after the volunteers, the ones who actually go to sea, providing them with the best possible boats in which to carry out the rescue. I think back to stories I covered and stories other lifeboatmen told me in making documentaries about the RNLI. And at times, the boats they went in, for example, the Mary Stanford, which carried out the Daunt Rock rescue in February of 1936, the one and is still on a cliff overlooking the sea at Ballycotton because the local community wanted to keep the boat forever as a memory of what was achieved. That was an open cockpit, the crew protected only by a windscreen, and there were 63 hours at sea. I think of the Royal Concorde rescue, the ship that broke in two, the tanker that broke in two off Rosslare, and the great Dick Walsh, the coxswain there. Again, an open cockpit. Now lifeboats where the crew are in properly protected seats, proper gear is much better than it was. Everything is given. And I think that change, which has become a change focused on what's the beating heart of the RNLI to me, which is the people who actually go out and carry out the rescues. The skills they're taught, the concentration on the skills, the concentration on seamanship. And the other change, obviously, is that the core of the voluntary service, which used to be fishermen, that fishing industry has been suffering a downturn, so there's less fishermen around. But they've been replaced by people from all different types of occupations. Now, all those changes, I think, have married together. But I come back again to what I perhaps keep repeating. The focus of everybody on the boats is saving life. And that's, I still keep asking to this day, lifeboat people, I mean, what drives you to go? It's very often the family history. They go back in tradition, but it's also that core belief, I can do something to help somebody else.
You can listen to all 200 voices on the RNLI website, where there's more information about the celebration of its 200th anniversary. And may it continue for many, many more years to save lives at sea. So it's time to drop anchor again on this podcast and program. Until next month's program, go to the website for news and comment every week. That's at tommcsweeneymaritimepodcast.ie. And please email me with your comments to tommcsweeneypodcast@gmail.com. So the website, tommcsweeneymaritimepodcast.ie. And the email address, tommcsweeneypodcast@gmail.com. Phone and text 0872 555 197. That's 0872 555 197. Sound production by Justin Marr. Until next month's program, the usual wish of fair sailing.